it's not violation of conservation of energy. You study that article on page 47 of the March issue, 2015, and it'll clear up some of these crazy arguments. Let me drop it. Tune across the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and whenever the subject of standing wave ratio or whenever the subject of antenna tuners comes up, my goodness, will you hear a whole bunch of phony, what used to be called old wives' tales, if you know what I mean. And because so many people hear it for so many years, from so many locations, it becomes the truth, even though it's really in violation of conservation of energy, if you know what I mean. I know we've gotten off subject, but what I'm saying is that the impedance of a signal generator, if you're trying to make repeatable laboratory measurements, is a fairly important parameter that sometimes is ignored. And so, because you're using a simple potentiometer for output amplitude adjusting, you have to accept the fact that it's not going to be ideal no matter how it's used. Therefore, the exact number of ohms you use on that potentiometer is not super critical. In other words, you would think that if it used to be a 75-ohm pot, and if you put a 100-ohm potentiometer in there, that all hell's going to break loose. Well, you started off from a shaky position to begin with, from my point of view. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Great idea. I think you should take that note that you mentioned, the attenuator. He could add a 10 dB attenuator to that and mount whatever pot he'd like to mount in there. He'll be able to measure it. He can see if the range is good, and he'll be able to maintain a better impedance and solve a lot of problems. I'm surprised at Polar. They make good stuff, and I was very surprised to see this kind of an attenuator on there. But and by the way, I did read that email you sent me on the notes you sent to that gentleman writing those articles. Good stuff. And I have the issue. I just got it today, and I'm going to read that article and see what more he's got to explain there. Interesting stuff. Very good. Okay, let's go over to Paul for the space report. It's a quarter after. It's about time. KC2WGB with the mailbag is complete.
Yeah, for any of the people who know me, they know that I think my raison d'etre, the reason I was put here, is to study, use, and enjoy antennas, and to help design antennas. I think that's my reason for my purpose in life. So the April issue of QST 2015 is the so-called special antenna issue, and the way you feed your antenna, almost always there's going to be a transmission line. Almost always there's some small or large amount of standing wave ratio in that system, unless your antenna and transmission line and signal generator are completely ideal. And as such, some of the crazy readings you get of higher than normal power, reflections that don't seem to make sense, line lengths, you'd be amazed how many people believe that you don't get an accurate reading out of a bird directional watt meter unless it's put into a transmission line that is some multiple of a half wavelength long. There are people who believe that their antenna is not going to be giving full performance if the transmission line isn't some multiple of a half wavelength long. You'd be amazed how many people believe that. They hear it from so many sources, it becomes the truth. I hear people asking me from time to time, what will happen if I'm not able to make it an exact number of half wavelengths? Yes, it's going to work like a charm. I'll see if Paul's available. WS2N, what's going on in space, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Okay, very good, Dick. The information he wanted to know about Voyager 130. Not much different than last week, but, you know, 130 at Voyager 1. Astronomical unit they use. This week, yesterday they had a spacewalk, and it's one of three spacewalks that have to be performed to set up the International Space Station to eventually accept the new commercial spacecraft that will be going there within a couple of years. SpaceX will have the Dragon, and Boeing will have the CST-100. space station. Let me drop it. So, yesterday morning they had two astronauts, Barry Wilmore and Terry Burns, do a spacewalk to redo all these cables in front of the space station as a node. It's called the Harmony node, and that's where they're going to have these new adapters that will eventually be sent up this summer. Two flights by SpaceX will bring them up. They're called IDAs, or International Docking Adapters, that have to be put on the front of these PMAs, the pressure mating adapters that are presently on the International Space Station. The PMAs used to accept the space shuttle. They've been capped off since 2011, since STS-135 went up there, the last flight, and they put what they call a shower cap or cover over the front of it to protect it from micrometeorites and the different varying heat and cooling that happens as the space station goes around and around. So this first 6.5, almost 7 hour spacewalk was designed to lay out all the different cables, remove panels that were never designed to be removed, put a bunch of different plug-ins, and run the cables out to roughly where they're going to go to accept the international docking adapters when they arrive, and they'll be able to plug them in.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Off to a late start, one day late. They've had some problems with the spacesuits. One of the fans weren't spinning up properly not too long ago. So ground crew wanted to make sure that what they were looking at, one of the pieces of equipment that was brought back by SpaceX, would not fail during the spacewalk. So after that was all checked out, finally, they gave them the go-ahead. Another astronaut from the European Space Agency helped them get into their spacesuits and get them out the door, and then coordinate everything before and when they come back. And that's Samantha Christopher Eddy. Very good job. I watched the whole thing on the NASA TV. Very well done. By the way, she's the only amateur radio operator on board the space station. They have six people on station. And one time they had all six were amateurs. Right now she's the only one. In fact, the other day she did a telebridge conference with students in Pennsylvania. But getting back to these adapters, again, the whole idea is to accept the flights of SpaceX Dragon and the CST 100 by Boeing. So a lot of things have to be moved around. One of the big components, the permanent logistics module that's been put up there on one of the last flights, that has to be relocated. That will be done by the Canadian robot arm. That's going to make room for another PMA adapter. The idea is to have two of these IDAs, International Docking Adapters, installed. This way you'll be able to have two spacecraft attached, manned spacecraft attached at the same time on the U.S. side. And there'll also be two ports that will be used for berthing operations. That's what the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Foot tower. WS-2N, they just broke ground for a 200-foot tower for Boeing building a tower. Lodge Complex 41 down in Florida. And that's where they're going to be launching the Atlas V rocket when they have the crewed vehicle built. And each one of these crewed vehicles, by the way, can take up to 7 astronauts if they want to. Or a combination of less astronauts and more cargo. But this facility, this 200-foot crew facility to be able to bring a crew up and put them into a spacecraft on top, something like this hasn't been built since the 1960s. So they broke out on that, and hopefully everything will be ready within the next couple of years, getting ready for the United States to be able to launch their own people from our soil to the space station, do away with the Russian Soyuz paying $70 million of blast every time you send an astronaut up. Back to you, Dick, for any comments, and we have more stuff if you'd like. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Good stuff, Paul. Me being a tower lover from way back, boy, did my ears perk up when you said a 200-foot tower for SpaceX. Now I'm suddenly curious. On Launch Pad 39A, which is where I think they launched the Saturn V, their launch umbilical tower, which transports lots of hardware up there, but at the end it transports your astronauts into the command service module, the command module. How tall is the launch umbilical tower at Launch Pad 39A? I'd be amazed if that's not in the vicinity of 200 feet. So if the 200 feet is a new altitude, I'm kind of curious. I might have the numbers wrong here. Straighten this out for me, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, that whole setup consists of not only the ability to bring astronauts up to the top on the elevators, and, similar to what Boeing is doing right now, but you also had the whole clamshell of service setup, which would swing into place. You'd be able to bring in, put a satellite up in there and roll it into place, put it into the space shuttle. You can do stuff like that. Now that's all being taken apart little by little. And you had 39A and 39B. 39A is being taken over by SpaceX. SpaceX wants to put their Falcon 9 Heavy. Basically 27 Merlin engines bolted together, or three Falcon 9 rockets bolted. I guess in the 200-foot area as well, to bring people up to the top of the. Top of the entryway for the space shuttle. But this one here is strictly a tower. You're going to need an escape system in case something goes wrong. This is for not for SpaceX, but for SpaceX is going to build their own for this whole setup over in Launch Complex 40. This is Launch Complex 41 that Boeing and
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Part of what they call the ULA, United Launch Alliance, for all the Delta rockets let me drop it. I'm going to time out here. For all the Atlas V rockets. In this case, this will be the Atlas V. Put the CST 100 on top of that, and you'll be able to put 7 people on board, and that's 200 feet. And they broke ground on it. They're going to build it modularly away from the complex, and use a gantry setup to put the sections on top of one another. And it's going to take them a year and a half, about 18 months to build this thing. And then you'll have your elevators going up, and towers surrounding it, you do have four lightning rod towers that are surrounding the Earth. They do that for every launch facility. And they're always about 300 feet high or more. So, I don't know, I think I answered your question, Dick, but I'm more fascinated with getting everything ready on time, because the Boeing plans on launching people by 2017, probably mid-year, they'll run a first test, and I think SpaceX might be a little ahead of them, probably at the beginning of 2017. Back to you.
I know I'm hitting you cold with this question, Paul, and it's not quite fair, but what do you believe is the approximate altitude of Apollo 11 just before launch, the one that brought Neil Armstrong to the moon? I think that that whole vehicle before it took off was considerably more than 200 feet. I think it was closer to 300 foot of altitude of that vehicle. Am I wrong on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, the Saturn V, they were, what, 370 feet, something like that. So they were quite high. And the new SLS, the Space Launch System that NASA's building for the Orion spacecraft, that's going to be bigger. It's going to be around 400 feet, a little taller than the Saturn V, but naturally they improved on the output of these engines. There'll be a difference. You know, the big SLS system will be 130 metric tons. They'll be able to put in orbit. You know, you're talking about, well, go by thrust. Saturn V was 7.5 million, and the new SLS system by NASA will be 10.5 million pounds of thrust. Let's not forget about SpaceX with their Falcon Heavy. That's going to be, you know, in the six million pound area. So they're all getting up there, and that'll be the that one I want to see. That'll be going from 39A, and probably in August. That'll be their first flight. But basically, it's like taking three Falcon 9s and putting them together. Back to you.
10.5 million pounds of thrust. Whoa. That's a lot of force. Irresistible force. And almost an immovable object. Okay, if the Saturn V on takeoff for Apollo 11, we'll say, was 350, 375 feet, that tower had to bring those astronauts up to that command module. So that must have been at least a 375-foot-high tower. Therefore, the new tower of 200 feet is not that much taller. It's not taller. Now, maybe the 375-foot tower for Apollo on Launch Pad 39A got knocked down to a smaller size because the space shuttle is not that tall. Is that part of what's happening here, Paul? Old altitudes and the intermediate altitudes of the space shuttle and this new altitude of a tower at 200 feet. I'm trying to compare those. I've got them kind of mixed up, as you can tell. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, roughly the Atlas V, which we'll be launching the Boeing manned spacecraft, CST-100, is roughly about 200 feet high. And I think the Falcon 9 is about that high, a little higher. So they'll be building one too at their facility. Not only here, they have to build they're actually building a whole other port, spaceport down in Texas, near Brownsville, Texas, which will be eventually launching people as well. But these towers are going to be now all over the place. So figure about probably 200 feet for both SpaceX and for Boeing. And the Space Launch System, when that's built, that's going to have to be, you know, closer to 400 feet, you know. I think they even had to take out a panel or something on the vehicle assembly building for the air. Because they needed a little bit more height for the new SLS, the Space Launch System. But that, I mean, it's close. It's a little higher than the Saturn V. Back to you, Jeff.
Earlier you told me that the Voyager is out there now at 130 astronomical units. If I just use some rough approximation, astronomical unit, the distance between Earth and the Sun, very close to 93 million miles. And 130 of those is 12.09, call it 12 billion miles. At the speed of light, 12 billion miles, 300 million meters per second, takes 18 hours one way for the signal to get there. And when Voyager is talking to you, it's really a transponder. It's a kind of repeater in the sky. 12 billion miles up, 12 billion miles back down, 24 billion miles round trip. At the speed of light, that takes 36 hours. So you just say hello to Voyager, how are things going? And if you get an immediate answer, that answer at the speed of light comes back down 36 hours later. My goodness, is that DX. In miles per watt, at 20 watts or so of transmit power, out of a traveling wave tube that's 37 years old, what a system. That's the world's best repeater. Yes, it's called transponder. It really is a repeater. It's a kind of a bent pipe system. The uplink signal becomes the frequency reference for the way it transmits the sound, the signal back down to you, and it adds some data onto that signal. What's the battery voltage? What solar flux is it seeing, and so on. What a
question, Dick.
Okay, go right ahead, John.
Dick, question on the traveling wave tube. When it's in idle, is it in a quiescent state? Is that why it's lasting so long?
The way a traveling wave tube works is that you're sending this very narrow, highly focused beam of electrons down the center of the tube. The tube is probably in the vicinity of a foot long, the active portion of it, and there's this helical wire wrapped around that beam, and you inject a small signal into the beginning of that helix, and the way it, the interaction between the helix and that beam starts bunching those electrons, and so pretty soon at the end of the tube you've got a whole lot of bunching, and a great big strong signal comes out with 30 or 40 decibels of gain. And in some cases, lots of watts come out, even though you've only put milliwatts in. Let me drop. That's what happens when the tube is active. Now, there's at least two or three different ways you can put the tube into an inactive mode. You can stop it from transmitting a signal by simply stopping the input. But because every transmitting type traveling wave tube has a noise figure very close to 36 decibels. So you and I can calculate what is KTB noise. At room temperature, a 50-ohm resistor is putting out an amount of power of minus 114 dBm per megahertz. So minus 114 dBm is just raw noise of a 50-ohm resistor at room temperature. And you increase that noise power by 36 dB because of the noise power of the apparent front end of that tube. And then now, whatever gain the tube has, 30 or 40 dB of gain, that 36 dB of noise higher than KTB with another 30 or 40 dB of noise from the gain of the tube, you're getting an output noise that's 60 or 70 dB above KTB. So the tube can create quite a bit of noise, as you can tell. Now, so even turning off the signal doesn't mean it stops making noise. You can turn off the beam, and of course they do. The standby mode is usually the beam's turned off. You turn off the high voltage between the cathode and the anode. The way the tube usually operates, the anode is at ground potential for a whole bunch of reasons, and the cathode is sitting at minus 10,000 volts. And you kill the minus 10,000 volts and the beam is not there anymore. That's with the filament on. And then you can turn the filament off and now the tube is thoroughly in the sleep mode. But you got to be careful about that, because at least the tubes that we've got on Earth that are not space qualified, let me drop. A non-space qualified tube built with normal tender loving care, when it sits on the shelf, all of that material that's inside the tube, you get a lot of stuff in there. It's all slowly outgassing into what you turn the tube on if you didn't do a wake-up procedure and had been sitting on the shelf for 3 months. There's a chance you're going to arc over the tube because what you thought was a high vacuum inside is not anymore because all of your metal and glass and cathode materials, everything is slowly outgassing. And so the right way to wake up the tube, the wake-up procedure, is to turn on nothing but filament and cooling air and do that for a few hours with the hot filament making everything, all those particles running around there move faster. Your Gettering material, which is part of how you develop the high vacuum, your Gettering material is a fancy chemical on the inside that acts like flypaper, and it collects all of those free electrons. So if you're doing a careful use of the tube, you turn on just the filament for a few hours before you put on the high voltage so that the Gettering does its thing so you don't arc over the tube. Each arc over inside of the traveling wave tube is potentially damaging because it is sputtering and splattering material all over inside that tube, and the portions of it that you want to be a perfect insulator are not anymore because you've electroplated materials on there by the arc over procedure. Now, so my guess is in order to save battery power, they probably do go into a complete sleeper mode where they turn off the beam and turn off the filament. Well, turning the filament back on is doing a thermal shock. So if you really want to get maximum life out of the tube, you turn on that filament in a very small and a very careful, slow warm-up procedure, if you know what I mean. So you're not thermally shocking it. And if you haven't used the transmitter in a significant length of time, you should do this wake-up procedure before hitting it with high voltage. So, I'm guessing they do...
Repeater, timeout.
Transmit almost every other day.
Okay, so they don't have to do a wake-up procedure. So every other day they're doing a transmission. Wow. Do they need updates that often enough, Paul? Give me some more words on that. I assume they talk to it once a week or twice a month, because out there where the thing is, the conditions are not changing that fast. And you're also taking very valuable time on the Goldstone 14, the so-called Mars installation, the 240-foot dish. I mean, there's a zillion people demanding the use of that dish. And so if every other day it's being aimed at the Voyager, that's a bit of a conflict of interest. So give me some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, whoever transmitted, that was a perfect double. One at a time.
T2UJL with a question.
O2WQ with a design question. When you get a chance.
Okay, so we're going to take Tony and John in that order. KC2UJO, you got it, Tony.
And listen to this whole conversation. I have a question for Paul. I was watching the Discovery Channel, and they're creating a vehicle that will go up into outer space and grab a lot of the junk that we're not using up there that could possibly damage the equipment that we're using at this time. You know, as it circumferences the Earth, it could come into collision with the capsule or something, you know. And they're developing some kind of a sanitation vehicle that will capture this space junk and bring it back down to Earth before it damages the spacecraft that's up there. How true is that, Paul?
Japan is about a year away from a prototype. They're gonna send one up to see how it does. They've designed one like that. I don't know if NASA has anything on the books for a cleanup type of launches. I haven't heard anything like that. But Japan has one. What did they mention? Japan on the Discovery Channel?
No, negatory, but they did mention that we have a large amount of junk that's floating around up there, that if it ever comes into, hits one of the, one of the space capsule or space devices up there, it will cause a great amount of damage at the speed that it's traveling as it circumferences the Earth.
Yeah, we do have a lot of stuff up there. I mean, there are boosters up there and all kinds of junk. Just this year alone, worldwide, you've got about 55 flights that are going up from all the different countries, India, Japan, China, United States, Russia. something behind. Not to mention old satellites that aren't being used, so there is a concern for that. But right now, the only one presently working on something like that, as far as I know, was Japan. But, very good. Dick, I wanted to mention the... I know you're talking about the traveling wave tube, but to give you an idea, 1990 is when the last time the camera was used on board Voyager, and they turned it back and they took a series of shots looking at the whole solar system best they could, and a picture of Earth came out, and they called it just a pale blue dot. It was a couple of pixels, and that was 1990, and it was just past Pluto. Now you're three times that distance, or more than that, over three times the distance of Pluto from 1990, and that was the last time they used the camera. In fact, Anne Duran got on. She's the widow of Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was behind that whole deal. He was the one that talked him into taking that picture. And she had mentioned this. It was February 14th, 1990, 25 years ago. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Pluto is something like 38 or 39 astronomical units on average in a fairly elliptical orbit. So 120 astronomical units would be more than three times the distance of Pluto, and it's not 120, it's 130 astronomical units. It's three and a third times the distance of Pluto out there. If it took a picture now, I think Earth would not even be a single pixel anymore. Here's another crazy question. You're going to see where I'm going in order to answer Tony's question, and that is, do we know an approximate number of objects that we have in orbit right now around the Earth? In low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, geosynchronous high Earth orbit. If somebody told me that there is 5,000 objects, just I'm talking about spacecraft in orbit, you take a look at the whole Iridium satellite system and the global positioning satellite systems and the Kedra satellite systems and so on. If someone told me there's 5,000 objects in orbit, I'd sort of believe it. Am I high or low from what you know, Paul? You're going to see what I'm going with this. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, there's over 1,000 and roughly 1,500 operating satellites. So now you could, you know, there's a lot more that have died, probably four or five times that amount. So, and then all the broken pieces, NORAD tracks everything bigger than a couple of centimeters, you know, like 3-4 inches. Pieces of everything. They track it all, you know. Who knows, 20,000. I've seen diagrams of it. It's got to be 20,000, if not more, probably 40,000 pieces that they're tracking. A swirl of junk going around the Earth. We're going to have a ring. You look at the Earth from a distance, you know, maybe 100 years from now, we're going to look like Saturn with a big ring around us. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so NORAD might be keeping track of 10 or 20,000 objects that are a few inches in diameter. And they're moving in low Earth orbit, they're moving at 17,500 miles an hour. In the highest reasonable orbit, geosynchronous orbit, they're moving something like 6,500 miles an hour. So it's a whole lot of maybe 10 or 20,000 objects, 4 inches or bigger in diameter, moving somewhere between 6,000 and 17,000 miles an hour. That's all. And some of them are in polar orbit, some of them are in equatorial orbit, a lot of them are in orbits at all other kinds of altitudes. Let me show you a problem. Let me drop. In the case of the space shuttle Columbia, which got in trouble, they knew that some damage occurred, and that in theory they could have gone to the International Space Station, but they were not in the same orbit. Even if they were at the exact same altitude, but you just have a slight different inclination of orbit, to change your orbit inclination is like restoring steering a gyroscope. When you're in orbit around the Earth, even though you're not a complete ring, you really are in a very strong gyroscopic action situation. If Columbia wanted to change its inclination of orbit to try to meet up with the International Space Station, to go there in order to figure out how much damage had occurred to Columbia, and you burn up every bit of fuel you get on board, you could just barely move the orbit 6 degrees change in tilt of orbit, in orbit inclination. All the fuel you've got can barely change your 6 degrees because you're steering a very heavy gyroscope. Let me drop.
Dick, they were around 26, and they have to change to 56.1. That ain't going to happen.
You've really proven my point. So they needed 20 degrees of change, and 6 degrees of change is all you can get if you burn up every bit of fuel you got on board. So therefore, even if I had the world's most perfect garbage-collecting spacecraft, like Tony is talking about, and all of those pieces out there, you've got 10 or 20,000 pieces of stuff you'd like to collect. They're all at different altitudes, different inclinations. It's going to take a fleet of many thousands of spacecraft with a whole lot of fuel just to steer into those different altitudes, different inclinations, just to get anywhere near those pieces of junk. As I see it, you can dream about this just like we can dream about going to Mars. And we've got hundreds of people who have already volunteered to go on a one-way trip to Mars knowing they will never come back. I mean, we can dream about going to Mars. We can dream about a spacecraft that's going to collect all this stuff. If you look at the physics involved, I think if you spent all the money you could gather, I'd be amazed if you could gather 1% of that stuff in any reasonable number of years. So that's a huge problem. I know John had something he wanted to ask. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, on the traveling wave tube, I was thinking about something you had mentioned last week or the week before. We already have a vacuum in space. Now, when they designed the wave tube, traveling wave tube, if you remember how years ago when medicine, a liquid medicine was dispensed, it was in ampules, and you would just snap the little top off. I'm wondering if they could leave an ampule-type connection with maybe a little solenoid, and they could pulse the solenoid and break that tip of the ampule off, and that would allow the space vacuum to accommodate any pressure that was in that tube, which is left over because we couldn't get a vacuum as close to space, I don't believe. What do you think?
It has some merit, John. However, the orbital OSO, Grumman built something called the Orbital Satellite Observatory, where some of the electronics had to be in a hard vacuum to work correctly. And they had holes in the chunk of electronics so that the air inside the electronics would go out the hole, be drained into space, therefore you'd get a high vacuum. Whenever you do that experiment, you really discover something that's very humbling. Those air molecules in there are moving, if they're at the room temperature, they're moving 500 meters per second. They're bouncing off those walls like crazy, bouncing off each other. And you drill a hole in the side and say, I want them all to go out that hole. You'll be amazed how long it takes for them to find the hole. In the case of the Grumman Orbital Satellite, Orbital Astronomical Observatory, I think it was in space for some number of hours, and then they turned on the high voltage and it arced over and damaged the electronics because those air molecules hadn't found the holes. So the good news about Voyages is it's got a whole lot of time. If you wait long enough, those molecules are eventually going to find the hole. But as such, whenever you want a high vacuum, you pump out, let me drop. You pump out as much air as you can in a reasonable length of time and hope those air molecules find the hole to your vacuum pump. But then you use this gettering material, as I said, that acts like fly paper to collect the rest of it. And the problem you've got with a traveling wave tube of normal manufacture is that even if you had a perfect vacuum on day one, all of those materials in there are slowly outgassing. Now, one built a space qualification for something like Voyager. I'd like to believe they use 10 times the amount of effort they normally do to make sure everything is super clean, so there's almost no outgassing of those materials. They must have done something like that for that tube to survive 37 years. That's a record, from all I know. And if they do a good job of sealing the envelope after they create the best vacuum they can, you don't have to worry about air running back in space. On Earth, maybe some of the failures in Earth is that the air outside at room temperature, room pressure, is slowly leaking back inside the tube. Maybe that's part of what's going on. And in space, you don't have that problem. Maybe that's part of why they're able to survive so long. So it's a good idea, but you got to be careful how you use it. If you and I made an estimation as to how long it takes to drain the air in space through that hole, reminds me of somebody who drills a hole in the bottom of his rowboat to let the water out while he's floating the boat. It takes a ridiculous length of time. The statistics of all those billions and billions of molecules, some significant number of them are pesky and they're not going to find that hole, even though you put a great big sign, exit is this way, KC2WGB, K2RIW, to the egress.
Yes, this way out. Well, I just thought if they evacuated it, they've eliminated it as much as they could, and then if the tube is in space and they were to break that ampule tip off, maybe some more of those electrons those elements will find their way out. Those molecules will get rid of them. But maybe it's not necessary. You might be right. The migration may be from the Earth's atmospheric pressure migrating through very minuscule areas in the glass itself. Good point. Back to you, Dave. Thank you.
Pretty quickie.
Yeah, go ahead, quickie. And who are you?
AT2, UJL. I was listening to you. Just offbeat question. We're worried about comets coming and hitting this planet. With all that junk we got floating around, that changed the subject. You know, that stuff's going to be coming home soon. Eventually, it's going to get into the gravitational pull of the Earth, and it's going to be coming right back home. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
It burns up every day. Every day, there's stuff coming back.
Yeah, you and I would like to believe, Tony, that the air goes up for 6 miles and then stops. It doesn't. 6 miles is where we think our atmosphere is. And as you go to 12 miles, 18 miles, 24 miles, the atmosphere gets thinner and thinner. It never goes to zero. Everything that's in low Earth orbit, including the International Space Station, is experiencing atmospheric drag. A couple of times per year, when you send a cargo ship up to the International Space Station, whatever fuel is left over is used to boost the International Space Station back up to its original altitude. It is always completely slowly sinking. So everything in low Earth orbit is going to come back. Everything in medium Earth orbit, 10,000 miles up, yeah, it's going to come back. But now the atmosphere is getting so thin out there, let me drop it. That maybe its lifetime is 1,000 years. When it comes to synchronous orbit, altitude 22,300 miles, there the lifetime out there is, for all I know, it's 10,000 years. Yeah, it's going to come back, but very, very slowly. So we've got a lot of stuff in various altitudes, various orbits, various ellipticity ratio, you know, various elliptical orbits and so on. Lots and lots of stuff. Now, the good news is that the stuff that's in orbit around the Earth is only moving at speeds of like 6,000 up to 17,000 miles an hour. When you get an asteroid or a comet hitting the Earth, quite often they're hitting at numbers like 50,000 miles an hour. What kind of velocities have we seen with comets and asteroids? Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that stuff's going to come in, 30,000 to 50,000, comet maybe even higher, but if it gets pulled in by the sun, you know, you might have something coming in at 80,000 miles an hour. So, and there's something, is it 50 tons of dust and comet stuff, asteroids, and coming back? back, I think, some 50 tons per year of space dust. Not stuff that we put up there. Stuff, you know, rock pebbles, comet debris coming through the atmosphere every year. It sounds like a big number, 50. It's the equivalent of, like, taking 50 cars, grinding them up into fine little dust, and sending it back every year, Dick.
Yep. There was a report that I read in Newsday Science section a week or so ago. Talked about the number of pounds of stuff that falls on the Earth and the number of pounds of hydrogen and helium that goes to the top of our atmosphere and the solar wind peels it off. And now you look at the pluses and minuses. Turns out we're losing material faster than we're gaining. We're losing at a very slow rate, but we're losing. So the stuff that's being boiled off the top of our atmosphere is a little bit more in total pounds per day compared to the stuff that's falling in. Now, here's something interesting. The escape velocity from the Earth at the surface of the Earth is something like 7 miles per second. So you've got something moving 7 miles per second away from the Earth. In theory, it's got enough velocity to escape forever. Anything less than that, it's like throwing a baseball up in the air. It's going to come back. Let me drop. That's escape velocity. And now you can play that movie backwards. If I'm standing out in space at a very long distance, and I got a bowling pole in my hand, and I let go of it, the Earth gravity out there is pretty weak, but it's not zero. That bowling ball will slowly fall toward the Earth. By the time it goes through that whole acceleration process, it gets down to the surface of the Earth, it will be moving 7 miles per second. It's the same movie you're playing backwards. 7 miles per second is 25,200 miles an hour. So an object with no initial velocity, just freely falling toward the Earth, will be moving at 25,000 miles an hour. If something had initial velocity toward the Earth, and now that falling velocity is added to it, you can see how you can easily get numbers like 50 and 75,000 miles an hour, a comet or an asteroid coming to us. So our space junk is only between 6,000 and 17,000 miles an hour. The stuff coming from outer space is a hell of a lot faster. Which can do more damage? Which one has more of it? There's a whole lot of variables involved here. I do know that when they do a launch, whoever the launch facility is, I'm pretty sure they do a check with NORAD as to this particular launch at this particular time. Of all the 20,000 objects that NORAD is keeping track of, what's my probability of hitting one of those that you, NORAD, are keeping track of? I'll bet you they do that kind of a check before a launch. Have you heard words along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's being checked all the time, plus your satellites. Your space station usually moves two or three times a year due to some kind of debris that's coming their way. I'm not talking about meteors, you know, the stuff that we got up there. But the station itself has had to actually move a couple of times a year. Interesting. And to save fuel, they'll actually turn the solar panels on, you know, straight on edge to so that they don't have to keep, you know, you'll be able to have the space station actually moving faster. You'll change the air, or won't slow down as much by just changing the solar panels. Just enough to make sure that it doesn't intersect with something that NORAD has notified NASA about. So, because, you know, they're up in space, but it's very rarefied up there, but there's still some molecules. And by actually putting the solar panels edge on, make the space station keep up its speed and change its bulb to something that got loose, you know, 20 years ago.
Got a solution for it.
What's that solution, John?
Well, when they complete this new laser they have, that high-power laser, they could put it on something like the Hubble and send it up and let it vaporize what they can vaporize and eliminate a lot of it.
Sounds good, but it's not a complete solution, John. the laser beam, you take your chunk of space junk and you break it up into smaller pieces. That means each piece hitting you is going to do less damage, but now there's a lot more of them. You can't make matter disappear just because you hit it with your laser beam. It's still there. You've just broken it up into smaller pieces. You've taken pieces of junk that NASA, that NORAD can track, and now you've made it into a cloud of particles they can't track anymore. It's not a complete solution. It's a slight improvement, but it's not a glamour fix as I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
WS2N, I've told you about the space paint particle, Dick.
Let me let John modify his space blasting gun and then turn it over to you, Paul. Go ahead, John.
Well, I agree with that, Dick. Like, blowing up an asteroid could be a disaster because then we have more of them hitting us doing the tremendous damage. But the smaller particles, those things could be vaporized into things, dust, that really wouldn't harm a craft. But, you know, you take something like a one-inch bolt. Boy, oh boy, that thing hits a spacecraft. It's over for the spacecraft. That could be vaporized by a laser into just infinitesimal little particles.
If there is an advantage of doing it, how long something stays in, say, low Earth orbit, where it's continuously experiencing atmospheric drag and slowly going to a lower orbit, and eventually it's going to come back. How long something stays in orbit is a function of its mass-to-area ratio. A very massive object with very little area is going to stay there a long time. A very light object with a lot of area is going to come back real fast. So when you aim your solar panels, which have got a lot of area, so that they edge on to the direction of travel, you get a lot less atmospheric drag, and therefore the International Space Station can stay up longer. Paul's going to be telling us how often they do a boost. And I bet you it's 2 or 3 times per year, at least, to keep it at its altitude. And if for any reason we lose the ability to send up cargo ships and other spacecraft that can do the boosting, your International Space Station will slowly come back. At the altitude it's at, I suspect its lifetime in space is something like 10 years. But if you let that sink pretty fast, you're going to have to do an awful lot of work to put it back up again. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Hey, chance, Dick.
And the lower it gets, the more air there is, so, you know, it just gets worse and worse real fast. Every time a progress ship goes up, any of the vehicles, whatever fuel that they have on board, especially in the Russian side, the ATVs have gone up, the automated transfer vehicle that built by the European Space Agency, the one that just left, before it left, it did a boosting of the space station, probably about 10 to 14 miles higher. Let me drop it. So, any of the progress ships have done that work. The space shuttle used to do it. They want to keep that station roughly, it's always around 250 miles up. That's what they like to keep it. I just want to tell you about the space paint, that speck of paint that came off of a spacecraft from a launch from Israel. I know I've told the story before. Had hit the space shuttle window, created a ding in it. Now, it didn't go through the glass, but the glass was like 4 inches thick on the space shuttle. So it created a ding right in the window. And they figured out that this paint chip was from an Israeli spacecraft. Now, Israel, when they were launching rockets back in the 80s, they're not allowed to launch over land, so they launched west. And actually, all our spacecraft, we always launch to the east. So we hear the all the shuttles are going east at 17,500 miles an hour. And the Israeli spaceship, spacecraft that they had launched, a satellite, went in the opposite direction at 17,500 miles an hour. So over 30,000, like 34,000 miles an hour, this paint chip hit the shuttle and created a ding in the glass. So, that's the kind of damage. So even if you vaporize all these bulbs and things that are up there, I mean, what are you going to vaporize it down to? Smaller than a paint chip? I don't know. Everything could do that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What I said at the end was everything could do damage at that high speed. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you get a chance, Dick.
Okay, Tony. And the amount of damage is not linear with velocity. It's a function of velocity squared. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². So with an Israeli satellite circling from east toward west, and our satellites are circling from west toward east, therefore the closing velocity is 35,000 miles an hour, twice normal speed. That's four times as much damage. Also, when it comes to asteroids and comets that someday are going to be aimed toward the Earth, so to speak, if you blast them into smaller pieces, you do get an advantage, because when something penetrates the atmosphere, is above a certain diameter, it has a good probability of going all the way through the atmosphere and creating something like Meteor Crater in Arizona. And if you make the particles smaller, they get burned up when they hit the atmosphere. So there is an advantage when it comes to stuff hitting the atmosphere. When it comes to stuff hitting your spacecraft, do you really come out ahead when there's a whole lot of small particles versus a very few big particles that you can track? I ain't sure. We're going to turn it over to Tony. KC2, UJL, K2RIW. You got it, Tony.
I'll tell you one thing, KC2, UJL. Like you said, I watch, you know, the Discovery Channel. I watch it a lot. And this old couple, I think they lived in Nebraska, in the middle of the night, they heard something hit the house. And what happened was something about the size of a softball, made out of some kind of material, came through the roof of the house and landed in the basement. And what happened was it was a piece of space junk, it turned out to be. And, you know, it was really hard material, and it did make a hole through the house. I guess maybe NASA maybe paid for the repairs of the house. But they were old couples in the middle of the night, heard that crash coming through. And I was just wondering, in talking in this light here, when the shuttle was damaged, you know, the heat shield was damaged on the shuttle, do you think maybe a small piece or particle of space dust might have damaged one of the heat sinks? That's why when it was coming in for a landing, one of the heat sinks were damaged, Dick?
Yeah, when Columbia broke up on reentry, because of that damaged leading edge tile made out of carbon-carbon material, and therefore the hot air coming into that hole literally melted down the wing, and the whole aircraft came apart. Boy, they had pieces all over the place. I think they were searching for pieces of the Columbia over a 3 or 4 state area, from eastern Texas to Louisiana, Alabama, in that area, a whole lot of stuff. And so, an object returning from space. I know that when when Skylab came back, I think a piece of that material ended up in Australia in an open field, but it was found. When it comes to, if anything goes wrong and the International Space Station comes back, I think you told me it's roughly 1 million pounds in orbit, Paul. Let me drop. And you've added this docking mechanism to the back end of the Hubble Space Telescope. At the end of life, I guess they'd like to attach a remotely piloted booster to it and bring it down in a controlled area like the Pacific Ocean. So the stuff that we got in space right now, the ones that are going to come back, that are in a low Earth orbit, everything's going to come back. In medium Earth orbit, after some significant number of years, it's going to come back. So some of these are not going to be controlled reentries.